Hey, thanks for tuning in again to another episode of Eat, Pray, Judge. This is Gabe Pacheco, as always, and I wanted to let you in on something, listeners, that we had some technical difficulties this week, and so the episode ends abruptly around 43 minutes, unfortunately. But just to give you a heads up, we all recommended this movie, so you're not missing out on too much. But before we get started, I want to introduce you to our guest. This week, we've got Will Carey, who is a stand-up comedian in New York City, and he also has a wonderful podcast called Between Awesome and Disaster, and he is in a punk rock band, and you can check them out on Bandcamp at Bright Ugly, brightugly.bandcamp.com. So with no further ado, let's dive into SLC Punk.
Hey, everybody. Welcome back to Eat, Pray, Judge. Today, we are going to be talking about 1998's SLC Punk. 1998, what a crazy year. I think we've covered it a couple times on this show already, mm-hmm. Sammy.
A little bit.
Today, we're going to cover it with a new friend, a special guest. Today, we've got Will Carey on the show, another fabled New York City comedian. Grizzled. He's been here for years.
fabled from the stable.
That's right. What's up, Will? How you doing,
man? I'm doing great, Gabe, just on that comedy grind, you know, just on that hustle, as they say.
That's right. That's
I'm
right.
doing great, man.
Dude, I'm so excited to have you on the show. I did your podcast a couple months back, and we had a really lovely time talking, and then we only touched on hardcore punk rock for a moment.
Yeah.
You know, and so I was thrilled when you suggested doing SLC Punk with us here in the Eat, Pray, Judge headquarters.
Oh, I was so excited you wanted to do this film, because I rarely get to talk about this movie.
Yeah. So did you see it when it came out in 1998?
I didn't see it the year it came out. I saw it probably maybe 5 years after it came out. I was still in high school, and I remember renting it on VHS from the Blockbuster Video in Prince Frederick, Maryland, where I'm from.
Oh.
Yeah. Like
your age and geographically relevant to Gabe and I. I love it.
Yes.
It does not happen very often.
This is a very DMV podcast.
Yes, it is. Are you from the D.C., Maryland area also?
D.C. specifically. Yeah, we grew up not too far from each other.
Oh, great. So
area.
Yes, yeah, so I'm from Calvert County, about an hour and a half south of D.C.
Cool.
That's where I'm from.
We bought one of our family dogs from a breeder in Calvert County.
Oh, nice. Excellent.
Yeah, and D.C., of course, is a hotbed for the hardcore punk rock scene.
Oh, 100%.
The whole Discord label.
Yeah, you know, Fugazi, Minor Threat, Henry Rollins' formative years are in D.C. There is a lot of...
Sure.
Bad Brains. You can't forget the best.
Oh, yeah.
Henry Rollins' story, the older I get, the more sort of like a Cinderella fairy tale, it sounds like.
Yeah.
You know, he's like, he's this punk rock dude working at a Haagen-Dazs in Georgetown,
right.
And takes a bus ride up to, or whatever, gets in a car with Minor Threat and some other Discord boys, and they go up to New York City where they see Black Flag play. And
mm-hmm.
and he's like, I could be your lead singer. And they're like, yes, Henry Cinderella Rollins, here is your glass microphone. And then, you know, and then history is made, and he ends up, that's like kind of the fantasy, you know, the dream, mm-hmm. that every, I think, punk rock aspirational like lead singer has, is that some band will pick me up and make me a star.
Oh, absolutely. And especially like a band you're a fan of also.
Yeah.
It's sort of like that guy, Ripper Owens, who was singing in a Judas Priest tribute band, and then later on became the lead singer of Judas Priest before Rob Halford rejoined. It's
yeah.
kind of like that. It's exactly. It's 100% a rock and roll Cinderella story.
It's like that movie Rockstar with Marky Mark. He's like the exact same.
Yeah, that's who it's based on. Yeah,
right. And then there was the guy that played for Journey. We're talking about bands that are completely different from anything this movie has to offer. But
hey, we're just talking about music, man.
Yeah,
it's all
sure.
It's all love. Music is all love.
It's true.
Is yeah, it? Man.
So 1998 this is fun, because I remember Armageddon came out that year, and my sister had a big Armageddon poster in
really?
Her bedroom. Yeah, I don't know. I feel like it was a free promotional
right.
poster, but that existed. Mm-hmm. You know, when you're like a little, you're little and sure. you just want, you want to put something on your walls.
I had lots of posters.
Oh yeah, absolutely.
Sure. So I don't think like she really liked that movie explicitly, but it was just like a cool.
Yeah, it was like a cool thing to have, and especially if the movie theater's giving away those promo posters, that's like primo wall space. I had one of those for The Watchmen when that movie came out.
Right on.
Yeah, that like super. It's like a super cool formative time to be around in that. I was 12 in 1998, so I was like still going to see Mulan in theaters. And
Did you have a Mulan poster?
I didn't get the Mulan poster. The Prince Frederick Apex Cinemas wouldn't let me have one.
Oh man, dude, I had posters of bands I didn't even listen to just because I liked how they looked. Like there was this place in Friendship Heights. Mm-hmm. Which is the neighborhood in Northwest DC, but they had a mall that had this one store that was kind of like our Spencer's Gifts, mm-hmm. you know. And there was like video. They had the Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles 4-player video game system there.
Arnold's.
Yes.
Yep.
And they had all these posters, and I got a poster of Iron Maiden just because I like the zombies on the cover of the Iron Maiden posters.
Yeah.
You know, it's like who cares about this band? I don't need to hear any of it, but I love this zombie on a motorcycle. You know, mm-hmm. hopping out of like, you know, 3D jumping at you.
Oh yeah, absolutely. Like,
where I got my first CD.
Oh yeah?
Yeah. Remember the packaging CDs used to come in?
Sure.
It's like a foot long box.
Oh, and then with the giant like 3-foot long anti-theft plastic thing.
Yeah, exactly.
And you have to the clerk behind the counter have to put like a giant key and just like finagle it. With it. Yep. Yeah, I remember still using those from when I was working retail just out of college.
Gotta stop theft.
What was your first CD again, Sammy?
Actually, the first two tapes I was ever given, I think I've touched on this before, were Run DMC's Raising Hell and Jimi Hendrix's Electric Ladyland. My dad bought them for me,
mm-hmm.
oddly enough. But then that was like a place in Mazza Gallery, which is the mall that Arnold's Disc Shop was in. We used to just go there and play video games, rolls of quarters. We were like 8, 9, 10,
yeah.
11, 12. It was like a disc shop, posters, and in the back, more records, and about 6 video games.
I would have lived in that place if I was anywhere close to it.
I wasn't far from it. That's where I first saw the quarter on the machine move. Mm-hmm. Like I got next.
Ah, right. Yes.
Like the nerd version.
Uh-huh.
Right. Well, you do that on pool tables, too, I think.
Sure.
Right? Yeah.
So. Yeah.
So, but that was like the first time somebody did that and they didn't say what they were doing.
Yeah.
And I was like, what do you think is going to happen here? I'm going to keep playing Double Dragon.
I don't see any quarters on this.
Exactly. And then you just take their quarter and be like, what the fuck, bro?
I don't see nothing.
Yeah. It was a very patriotic year. Saving Private Ryan came out.
Yeah. Well. Yeah. Saving Private Ryan came out. I think, The Big Lebowski and Deep Impact also came out this year, I want to recall.
Yeah.
And the other crazy thing, just because this made me think of it, 1998 is also the year the Monica Lewinsky scandal broke.
Yep.
Uh-huh.
Right at the beginning of the year. So
we've recontextualized that. People are re-examining it as Billy Clinton, the sexual predator.
Sexual, you know? Impeachment.
Right.
A little bit different than this one. Let's go around.
Yeah, sure, because, I mean, she was, what, an intern, young, impressionable? Yeah. He's the most powerful man in the world?
Yes.
How are you going to say no?
Yeah. If anything, you just want the story for later. It's like, oh, yeah, when I was 22 working in the White House, well, let me tell you a story. I'm like, Grandma, it's late.
Yeah, and Google came out this year, which was
huge.
That was the beginning of the end.
Oh, right. Yeah. I remember, what was your search engine of choice before Google took over? Mine was Ask Jeeves.
Yeah. I love that butler.
Yeah.
That was the one. Sure. Well, the internet was so different back then because there was nothing. I would search Black Flag and nothing would come up.
Wow.
I'd search bands.
What a dark time.
You know, and you'd be, and also the images took so long to load.
Uh-huh.
So, but yeah, I think I would search bands to see where they were. And like, there was no Wikipedia pages yet. There was no, I don't even think people were like digitally archiving themselves in that way. A lot of information you still had to get from zines, like printed out zines,
mm-hmm.
Maximum Rock and Rolls.
Yeah.
Bowie launched his own internet service, basically called BowieNet in 1998. It was just a dial-up service with like a website link and like a bio. It was up till 2006, so it had a solid run.
Yeah.
His own internet.
He was forward thinking.
Cutting edge.
That is such a Bowie move. It really is. The other another interesting thing, because I looked up like what the Billboard Hot 100 number one songs were of the year. And of course, this is also the year Titanic came out, right? And was, well, it came out in December, but it just took over the world in 1998. But the song that was number one on the Billboard charts for the most weeks was a Brandy and Monica song called The Boy Is Mine. Mm-hmm. It was number one the entire summer on the Hot 100. And that perplexed me because I've not thought about Brandy or Monica as singers in a really long time.
yeah, maybe that's what the militants who were in the Al-Qaeda training camp in Afghanistan were listening to when the U.S. launched cruise missiles at them in 1998. The Boy Is Mine, and the male got vaporized.
Yeah.
And in researching the year to realize that we were already at war with Al-Qaeda years before 9/11, mm-hmm. during Clinton's presidency.
Yeah, well, this was also the year there, because the U.S. was trying to get Iraq and Saddam Hussein to end its nuclear weapons programs, and they weren't. There was I believe it's called the Iraq Disarmament Crisis or something to that effect.
Yeah.
But that was going on as well, which now people talk about as setting the stage for the war on terror.
That's right. And it's funny when you ask a nation to get rid of its nuclear arms program when it's like, but we don't have one.
Yeah,
exactly.
Also, you guys have them. We're like, no, it's cool. We're good.
Yeah. They're like, we don't have those because all the weapons we have are weapons that you sold us. Yeah. And you clearly, do you see on a receipt anywhere where we bought enriched uranium from you?
Remember when you guys gave us all that money to fight the Russians and the Afghanis and the Iranians? Yeah.
Yeah, exactly. It's like, this seems abusive. Seems like backwards. Like you gave us all this and now you're mad at us that we have it?
Well, when you want to actually invade a country for oil, it's a long play. It's a long con.
Yeah.
Set the groundwork several years before, fund a bunch of different regimes.
Right.
You can get in and make it look like you're doing okay.
Yeah. It's like a multi-level marketing. It's like, you know, you get in on this ground level and then you have all these other countries and then they feed into those countries.
Right.
Comes a whole
trickle
thing.
Down.
Yeah.
On April Fool's Day in 1998, Burger King released an ad for a left-handed Whopper.
That would have been perfect for me.
Me too. Me as well.
With all the toppings shifted 180 degrees, it was obviously a joke.
Yeah.
But thousands of people came to several participating Burger Kings and requested the lefty Whopper.
Oh my god!
I wonder if you opt in as a Burger King. You're like, I too. They raise their left hands.
Yeah.
Like all the franchise owners.
That's a bad campaign.
I too participate.
I mean, I wonder what that conversation was like. I mean, were they like, we don't have it. It's just give them the same Whopper.
Exactly. Just put it in the paper at a different angle.
Hand it to them with your left.
I got to imagine if you working at fast food, you're already pretty probably bummed about that. But then when like the marketing geniuses who make way much more money than you do come up with some stupid thing that has people descending on your minimum wage job and like freaking out at you. No other fast food restaurant has done that recently. Popeyes. I imagine you just got to be like, you're making my life hell. I'm making $6.50 an hour to be here. Why?
Now I have to deal with irate left-handed weirdos.
And what was it like 2 years ago? Maybe the Szechuan sauce, the Rick and Morty craze when everybody was rushing McDonald's. Looking for Szechuan sauce?
Yes.
That didn't exist?
Yeah, the Szechuan sauce, which would have been available in 98 because Mulan was out.
All right.
Yeah, what a great way to tie this bow up.
Exactly. Always looking for those callbacks.
Well, I don't have anything else for 98, so I'd love to hop into this SLC punk with an exclamation point at the end.
Absolutely.
Never forget that.
Yeah, the exclamation point is key.
Yeah, you know, even that aesthetic made me think about the punk rock store in D.C. in Georgetown, Smash, where you could go and buy like a plaid kilt and a leather jacket and hair dye, Manic Panic hair dye.
Wait, so the Smash was on M or Wisconsin, which is
it was on M, and then there was Commander Salamander on Wisconsin, which was like a more bougie version of Hot Topic.
That's what that was. That's right. Yes. Smash was under Fattoush, the Middle Eastern restaurant.
Yes.
It was down that flight of stairs.
That's right. So, but now I believe Smash has relocated to Adams Morgan.
Sure.
So did Commander Salamander survive? Because that's a great name.
Isn't it a really cool name? I think they sold more like JNCO jeans, like maybe like purple velvet material JNCOs.
Yeah. Like I see.
Neo hippie raver youth culture store, as opposed to a appealing to gutter punky.
Sure, kids, sure.
It started, Smash. Yeah, it started as a gutter punky type place, a little bit, a little more mainstream than Smash.
Yes, yeah. You could get more like date, like like oversized T-shirts mm-hmm. with graffiti avatar characters in the left or right corners.
Oh, like the nu metal kind of uniform.
It was a poser store.
definitely a poser store.
Yeah, and I think posers thematically are going to come up a lot today, because this is the concept of the poser and like what is real versus like what is fake. I feel is heavily embedded in the fabric of SLC punk.
Well, yeah. So, brief synopsis, super brief, stolen from somebody's review on Amazon, is Matt Lillard stars as Steve-O, who alongside with his pal Bob decide to spend their post college year pissing their lives away, only to realize they and their friends must move forward with life and out of their unrealistic punk ideals. So this is a coming-of-age story.
Yeah, you know? It's a punk rock coming-of-age story.
Sure, sure, sure. The bananas are getting a little too brown. Mm-hmm. You know, their lifestyles are growing a little stale now that they're done with college. And Matt Lillard is great in this movie.
This is my favorite performance of his.
Sure, knew him first in Scream.
Mm-hmm.
And I thought he was so funny in that movie, and then in this. And then after that, I haven't really paid much attention. But I looked him up on Wikipedia, and it seems like he's cashing in Scooby-Doo checks left and right.
Oh, yeah. A lot of voice work for Scooby-Doo. All those like animated, direct-to-DVD DVDs of Scooby-Doo, and like they've partnered with the WWE, so like John Cena and the Scooby-Doo gang get into adventures together. He's the voice for all of those.
Yeah,
he was a great live action Shaggy. I saw like 5 minutes of that movie, and I was like, wow, that's pretty fucking good. Yeah.
I saw Matthew Lillard like a couple years ago. I used to work for an off-Broadway ticketing service, and the office was located in an off-Broadway theater on 42nd Street, and he came in to see the show that night. I was like, that's Matthew Lillard. I didn't get a chance to tell him I love SLC Punk, but I totally would have.
Yeah, so when you saw this movie on VHS right after it came out?
Yeah, a few years after it came out. I was, I can't remember the exact year, but I was definitely, it was post my punk rock awakening. So when the movie came out, I was maybe about a year away from discovering punk rock and then falling really deeply in love with the music and the style and the whole culture of the different subcultures of punk rock. So I was probably
the tribes
exactly. So I was maybe like, I was probably like 17 when I saw this, and I was interested in anything punk. So when I'm in Blockbuster and I see a VHS called SLC Punk, that might be interesting. So yeah, that's when I first saw this movie.
Yeah, yeah. And what was your initial impression?
I liked it. It was probably the first, it was definitely the first like low budget, like independently produced film that I saw, because prior to that point, my only access to movies was whatever my parents had in their library. So it was a pretty heavy diet of like mainstream studio comedies, nothing terribly challenging or risque. Everything very kind of like slickly produced with like actors that you would recognize. So this was the first time that I saw something, and I don't even think I knew who Matthew Lillard was at the time. So it was the first time I saw something that was like low budget, very kinetically, chaotically edited. Like it's a very sort of chaotic, spazzy kind of editing style throughout the entire film.
Yeah.
So yeah, it was also the first time I saw characters like breaking the fourth wall.
Oh wow, just talking directly
as well.
talking directly
to you or talking directly to the camera. So I was very intrigued by it.
Yeah, yeah. So this does seem like it's a great movie if it's sort of intro, you know, a first experience into punk rock. I think I saw this a little bit later, I'm a little bit older than you, and mm-hmm. Some of the first punk rock movies I saw were Repo Man,
mm-hmm.
and which also has a killer soundtrack and kind of has another protagonist that's becoming disillusioned with his scene.
Uh-huh.
And I don't know if you've seen that one, but
no, I haven't.
Oh, dude, yeah, that's from the era. I think it came out in like the early 80s, so it's takes place during the time that this movie's supposed to take place.
Right. It was capturing the time, whereas SLC Punk is like reflecting on the time.
That's right. That's right. And then Decline and Fall of Western Civilization,
mm-hmm.
which is a great documentary about this exact time period, but in LA.
Mm-hmm.
And so those were like the two films that I think I saw that kind of... And Suburbia. So there's three. Uh-huh. Suburbia is another one that has a cameo with Flea. Flea's in it.
Nice.
From the Red Hot Chili Peppers. And that's just a bunch of kids squatting in like an abandoned house in the suburbs.
Uh-huh.
So again, a grittier version of what was happening at the time.
Sure.
And this is sort of like you said, reflecting on it. So anyway, go back and check out those.
Okay, I definitely will. I always love when I love when I get new things to check out when I talk to people. It's all very exciting.
Yes. Yeah, and punk was big in DC. I think in the mid-90s, one of the best punk rock bands that I saw live several times was The Suspects.
Mm-hmm.
And I finally found them on Spotify. They just recently put out their records from that era on Spotify. So that's like a great street punk band to check out. But we had a big scene.
Yes. Oh my God. We definitely did. Like, and this was probably the first time. This is a metaphor. I can't remember if I said this when we were talking on my show, Gabe, but I sort of view like I got into punk through pop punk.
Yeah.
So my era in the late '90s, that was Blink-182, Newfound Glory.
Yeah.
Warning by Green Day. Yeah. That album that just came out. And the metaphor I make is that pop punk is like a Frappuccino. Like a really sugary coffee-based drink, and then you eventually get down to like espresso,
yeah.
And that's like Minor Threat and DOA and SOA, all the Bad Brains, all the abbreviation bands.
So pop punk is like gateway punk,
essentially.
Like,
yeah,
you know,
yeah,
people that got into the movement a lot later. Like when we were coming up, it was just the movement was sort of dying down a little bit. And Gabe and I were like turning 12, 13, or 14 in DC.
Mm-hmm.
But I remember seeing the Fuck Reagan spray painted on trash cans when I was like a kid in the alleys in D.C. The movement was much stronger. I mean, it was a real scene, as good as anyone in the country, I would imagine.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah.
Some of the most talented bands to come out.
Yeah, and then with like the seats of power and the system that punk is rallying against being right there.
Exactly. That's I think part of what made it what it was.
Yeah, mm-hmm. Nerdy children of government employees.
Yeah,
yes. Rebelling against their parents and all the levers of power they see right in front of them.
Mm-hmm.
It was a perfect time to rebel too, because the right wing religious presidency was perfect for it.
Mm-hmm.
It was ripe for teenage angst rebellion.
Yeah, and then and then I also think about like televangelism.
Sure.
Like, in the '80s, absolutely fake predatory religion.
Yep.
Absolutely. Another system of control and oppression.
Both just dollar scams.
To flip off and scream at.
Yep.
Yeah, so when we get into, you just brought up religion, and this movie takes place in Salt Lake City, which is what a mind-bending, you know, sort of like reality that we live in, where there's this theocratic state.
Mm-hmm.
Utah, and then this theocratic city, Salt Lake, where like clearly they haven't separated church and state.
Definitely not.
And to grow up in a place like that was founded by a religious cult.
Yeah.
Yeah. And then the director of this movie, James Madrino, grew up Catholic in that environment.
Yeah.
So he was isolated in the theocratic state, even though he grew up with religion.
That's right. That's right. Well, growing up in it's kind of like being a Jew or something. Like traditionally in any medieval Christian place, if you mm-hmm. grow up anything other than Mormon in Salt Lake, you are a minority regardless of what your, how mainstream your belief system is anywhere else.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I have Greek Orthodox family who lives in Salt Lake City.
Oh, really?
Yeah. But it's just weird. Like, if you're not a Mormon, you're not really going to succeed in that environment.
Right.
I find it interesting how in hindsight, after watching the movie, they didn't talk about the Mormonism as much as they did. They were just basically rallying against rednecks and hicks, which were their mortal enemy. And they were striving so hard to not be associated by any way, which is exactly what you would have to do if you grew up in that environment and you were not like that.
Mm-hmm.
And that's one of the cool points that I really enjoyed. I was like, that's such a perfect place to have like a good punk rock movement. Mm-hmm. Would be a place like, you know, a religious right-wing state.
Yeah.
Basically.
Like, and
almost autonomous from the rest of the United States in that way.
100%.
Yeah.
And like a comparatively culturally small hub.
Yeah, exactly.
Compared to like a city like New York or LA. Absolutely.
100%.
Dude, we get an opening scene here, and mm-hmm. the opening scene I thought was both hilarious and problematic in the most fun way. It's basically these two, I guess, rednecks are drinking, minding their own business,
mm-hmm.
overlooking beautiful Salt Lake City at night.
Yep.
And then they get hate crime assaulted.
Right, with metal pipes.
Yeah. Yeah. By our two protagonists. Mm-hmm. The heroes of the movie are just out there bashing normies.
Yeah.
And
because they represent America, and the voiceover before that, they say "fuck America." So we have a punk movie saying "fuck America" within the first 30 seconds.
Yeah, and I thought I'm already questioning whether or not I should be rooting for our heroes, because you know, I think we all love watching violence, but it's great when it's justified. It's great when you know
correct.
Why.
Mm-hmm.
Like, I want you want the background as to like why these dudes are, if they've actually done anything to deserve the beatdown they're getting.
Sure.
Other than just being who they are.
Yeah.
You know?
Right. So, you want to know the backstory of like, did they start the fight with the punks first or vice versa?
Yeah. Yeah. I think it's a very ironic opening. And
it kind of is.
I just assumed they were racist.
Yeah.
From the middle of Salt Lake City. That didn't bother me at all.
Yeah. I was kind of the same way. I was like, okay, well, I'm obviously rooting for the punks. So yes, beat up the rednecks. Do we need, no reason required.
Anybody that calls vagina pelt needs to get beaten. I think
that is true. Yeah. While getting ready to just like pee in the street.
Especially after you basically took the country away from people who use pelts.
Yeah, so yeah, I'm ambivalent. Yeah.
Zero issue with those guys getting rocked.
and then the intro song for the opening credits, we have thematically two things that kind of run through the whole movie. Sex and violence is the song.
Yeah, and this is kind of a thing about punk. I wrote a question. Was this actually promoting sex and violence, or was it naming a facet of society? Because like it's like tearing the veil away, or putting on those John Carpenter sunglasses, you know,
and yeah.
They live where you see exactly what the ads are telling you.
Mm-hmm.
Like, sex and violence is what culture is selling us. But if you're a dummy, you can listen to those lyrics and just say, the two things I love are sex and violence.
Yes.
Yep.
And like, so are you then becoming an idiot by like making that your mantra, or are you listening to that to help you see, distance you from that? Yeah. Does that make sense? Like
it does. Like there's a level of thoughtfulness maybe to the lyrics of that song that maybe the creators are putting through. And I think about this a lot too, especially since I think irony is slowly fading away in 2019,
yeah.
or picking up on sarcasm, because written communication over the internet doesn't give you the chance to pick up tone, like the wink wink hee hee, of certain things. So that's also exactly, I think that's a song that like, yeah, again, meatheads could just be like, yeah, sex and violence,
right?
And the band's like, you totally missed the point.
Well, it's kind of like how Paul Ryan says that his favorite band is Rage Against the Machine.
Yeah.
Because, where did that come from?
Well, because when the lyrics are "fuck no, I won't do what you tell me" to a song, no one's thinking about the leftist intentions of the rest of your lyrics.
Right.
Mm-hmm. That can be the battle cry for anyone. And so, like, with something like a song like, again, Sex and Violence, it's like when this song came out, like, oh, these are like art school dropouts writing a song.
Sure.
To let you know, to sort of spoon, to show you, put on a platter exactly what is being fed to you in commercials. Mm-hmm. But then, like, a little kid listens to that for the first time and they're like, oh, shit, I love, Sex and Violence. You think it's cool? I think it's cool.
Exactly.
So, like, the intention, nobody cares about the intention of the art. They just care about the final product is how it actually influences and affects people. Mm-hmm. And I think that's something that sort of, when I look at Heroin Bob and Steve-O, like, how are they internalizing their punk rock ideals?
You know? Sure.
What are their thoughts? Like, Steve-O, I'd love to talk about him for a while.
Yeah, let's do it. This guy, not only a great performance by Matthew Lillard in this movie, but probably the character with like the clearest, most clearly visible arc throughout the film. And yeah, a very interesting character. Let's get into it.
Well, I think he would be an alpha in any scene. So it doesn't matter what scene he would have chosen, because he's like a tall, skinny, charismatic dude who is rich.
Right.
And smart. So
exactly.
He could have easily been like the captain of like a pitcher on a baseball team. I don't want to say football team. But like, he could have been in any one of the tribes, would have been the top guy.
Exactly. Cause he's charismatic and, you know, I feel like he could definitely inspires loyalty and friendship. Cause you see it throughout the movie that people are always excited to see him.
Yes. Yeah. So with that, it's like the fashion is arbitrary. The fact that he became a punk is arbitrary. He's already and like you kind of know that he's gonna make it because he graduated from college and he has a very successful family that's pushing for him to go to Harvard Law.
Very unpunk rock, graduated from college.
Yes.
Yeah. I thought it was so interesting that he was into punk rock after graduating from college. Because I think of punk rock as kind of like, oh, it's like a thing that you do, that you're into in high school, or you don't actually go to college. You drop out and you start a band.
Or yeah.
You do something else where like maybe you start your own store, like the head shop that Heroin Bob's girlfriend has.
Yes.
Like, you know?
Yeah, some kind of.
Go ahead.
Oh yeah, some kind of subculture serving business, like or you know, a trade of some kind. Like I see those guys, like they work in music stores. Those I know lots of those guys, like are electricians or like plumbers, steam feeders. Lots of the guys from my hometown, so basically my tribe.
Yeah.
All go into some kind of trade. The drummer from my old band, I think, works at a concert venue in Oakland now. My bassist went into the Marine Corps for a while. They're all kind of like there's trades associated with that scene. That if you're not in a successful band or at least a touring band, that you tend to gravitate to, I've noticed.
Yeah, I felt like there was some arrested development, serious arrested development, that he would have gotten all the way through college and continued to be such a, like a, he calls himself an anarchist, but it's more like a nihilist.
Right. You know? Yeah.
And he's going to go, he's using, I think that I like read into that character as someone who has a chip on their shoulder, being so smart in such a small town. Because there's like no opportunities for culture or productive use of intelligence. He's using his argumentative skills on like the most trivial things, talking to people who are high in cars. like it's like wasting his intellect.
Yeah.
And then he resents his parents for moving from New York City to Salt Lake City. So it's like if he'd grown up in New York, I don't know, he would have been around peers. He would have been around other creative people. But instead, he's stuck here in this, like, Wasteland.
He might not Absolutely. Have been so special though.
He would, yeah, you definitely blend in a city in New York, especially like the New York City of the 80s, which also I believe had a pretty thriving hardcore punk scene at the time. Yeah, you're just another dude with a mohawk in New York.
And he's going to go to Harvard Law School. I think it's inevitable from the beginning of this that, you know, that's where he'll end up. And then I was just thinking, like, man, it would have been cool if he'd met Reese Witherspoon from Legally Blonde at Harvard Law.
That would be an amazing crossover.
That would have been like a Scooby-Doo style crossover. It's like the Harlem Globetrotters and Reese Witherspoon.
Yeah. Like, to see Steve-O and Reese Witherspoon's character, like, arguing a case would be amazing.
Yeah.
I would love to see that.
Yeah, well, maybe they could make a movie where the two of them, now that they're old, could be Harvard Law professors who are opposites attract, having to help out a burgeoning, like...
Just a rom-com?
Yeah, it could be a rom-com where they have to help out, like, the next generation.
Like, yeah.
Fiery lawyers.
Yeah, like they're... like a punk gets, like, wronged in some way, because there's a pretty famous, I can't remember any of the names, but there's a pretty famous case of a punk was beaten to death by a group of normies, and that's just the word I'm going to use, in Texas, and I believe the guy got off scot-free without having to go into jail or getting convicted. So I imagine that's a cause that Steve-O, the lawyer, would take up and excel at.
Yeah. This feels like it's an anti punk movie in some ways. Like, as much as it's a cool movie to watch if you like punk rock, it feels like it's an anti scene movie.
In a way, I think so. Well, I think the huge overarching theme of the movie, and I thought, and this came to me when I was rewatching it in my 30s now, the big theme for me is change, and ultimately the realization, coming to your realization that change is okay.
Yeah. It feels like this movie could be against any scene. And it's just like Salt Lake City is claustrophobic in its theocratic civil life.
Yeah.
The punk scene is also claustrophobic in this movie, because you're constantly like paranoid that someone's going to call you a poser.
Yeah.
You know, like if you deviate in any way from whatever the prescribed, like, rules are. And then also, in almost every scene, there's this constant discomfort that Steve and heroin Bob have around their friends, because they're advocates of chaos.
Yeah.
Chaos to them is defined by just like random acts of violence.
Exactly.
So at any moment, one of your good friends could pull a gun on you.
Sure.
Or like, just do like smash a wall or window or
punch a mirror.
Yeah.
Yeah.
A couple times that happened.
Yeah, that happens several times. And I believe it's Bob also. Bob has a problem with mirrors, which, if I was going to go film school, could be his sense of disgust with himself.
Yeah, 100%. That's what I got. I mean, his upbringing, obviously, we saw a glimpse into his father's life. So we understand that he's probably battling some demons there. He also has that sort of crazy-ish vibe gene in him.
Oh, yeah.
Also, he's a physical carbon copy of late stage Travis Bickle.
Yep.
Didn't put too much effort into his look there.
Got the same coat.
Yeah, same everything.
He has the exact same everything.
Doesn't seem to understand germ theory.
Yeah.
Like, he doesn't wash that wound.
Yeah.
Oh, God.
I do love that scene in the fast food restaurant where he just collapses and they're just like, is he going to be okay? He's like, oh, he'll be all right.
I don't know whether it's a testament to his acting job, but he was very difficult for me to watch. Like, I did not like him.
His presence,
I'm not a fan of Bob. Yeah,
I was a huge fan of the actor, and I was just felt sad every time Bob was on screen.
Yeah,
I felt so bad for him, being like, you know, it's like, oh, you got there's no hope when your father is a paranoid schizophrenic who lives in a shack and threatens to shoot you with shotguns when you visit to offer him birthday presents.
Yeah,
like that is, they played it for comedy to a degree, but it was like, man, on paper, that's like this. just the saddest thing.
Oh, there was definitely an underlying dark sadness there to him. It's not, I don't think it was a bit, I think the acting was solid as for Bob's character. I just don't, you know, there was a level of discomfort for me every time he was on stage.
There's a lot of pain that Bob, I think, is trying to conceal. Yeah. And I don't know about you guys, but I've definitely had friend groups where there is the friend who has a very fucked up home situation.
Yeah.
And deprogramming that and getting through that, it's hard to get done when you're like driving around in your small town smoking pot in the car.
Right. Or in any town smoking pot.
Yeah. Yeah. You can numb it, but that's not like fixing your deeper issues.
Right.
And I think one facet of childhood and early like teen years is that your friend group can be so big and your mind is so open that we all like you hang out with people regardless of what their mental illness is or what their challenges at home are, because none of those things have any stakes. It's that when we get older and people start getting jobs or responsibilities, that everyone kind of sorts themselves out into like whatever class they're in or from or how good their families were.
Yeah.
And like examples of that are like Bob and Steve-O are like so their trajectories are so different at this moment in their lives. They can live in the same place, but it's like the fact that Steve-O has a rich family and like he's getting into Harvard Law without even applying is going to separate him from Bob, who has to deal with the trauma of his upbringing,
who just really, really likes Trish a lot.
Yeah.
It's like, that's his lot in life.
And that's the best. That's like a great thing. That would have been fantastic if he'd lived to just be working at this head shop with Trish. And then there's Sean, the other friend they have.
Yeah. Who, like, played by Devin Sawa.
Yeah. And like, dude, at some point you might just go crazy. You do, like people do. And then I don't know, guys I know later in life, not later in life, but later in their youth became mentally unwell.
I feel like our experiences in the comedy scene, Gabe, we know a lot of people that are like teetering. We've known a lot of people that are teetering on the edge of disaster.
Yeah.
And you want to hope they get through to the other side. Well, and I think especially the scene where Sandy and Steve-O encounter Sean begging on the street. That was like, Steve-O, I think, was already on the path to eventually getting out of the punk scene, but I think that was one of the things that really like scared him straight, was that encounter with Sean.
Yeah, like you can't. There's a limit to romanticizing no future as a mantra.
Exactly.
And it's like Sean is exactly that, no future. It's like, what do you do? What happens to you once your family or whatever your support network stops putting up with your shit?
100%. And luckily, you find out in the sequel that Sean does get himself right.
Oh, thank goodness!
It's dire.
Hallelujah!
Yeah.
So he's in the sequel.
He is in the sequel. In the sequel, Punk's dead. He voluntarily checks himself into psychiatric rehab, and then by the time the sequel comes around, he's working for a Utah state senator.
That tracks.
I thought so too. When I saw Punk's dead, I was like, yeah, that makes sense.
I'm so glad you saw the sequel. I didn't even know there was one until we watched this for this podcast.
Mm-hmm.
And Heroin Bob has a son in that?
Yes, Heroin Bob has a son. He's sort of like a gothy, like a mod adjacent kind of goth, like a romantic type. Very, very much opposite of what Bob is or was. We don't want-